was snatched, he was shoved into the heat, and he was beaten up a lot. Like all low-status baboons, he was covered with bite marks. In between Solomon and Job, there was a chain of male control and command. Number four stood above number five and could take from him. Number five stood over number six and could take from him, and on and on. Your place in the hierarchy determined what you ate, whether you got to have sex, and every moment of your life. Robert would wake up in his tent every morning at 5:30 to the sounds of an awakening savannah all around him and prepare a medical kit and a tranquilizer dart. It was his job to go out and fire a tranquilizer at one of the baboons so he could take a blood sample. They became quite skilled at avoiding him, and he had to figure out how to fire when they weren't looking to dart them in the back. This blood sample would then be tested for several key factors, and one was how much of the stress hormone cortisol they were carrying. He wanted to know which baboons were experiencing the most stress, because he believed it could reveal something crucial. It turned out, when the blood samples were tested, that when there is a war on for the position of alpha male, the most stressed baboons are the ones at the top. But the vast majority of the time, the lower you are in the hierarchy, the more stressed you are, and the baboons at the bottom of the pile, like Job, are stressed constantly. To avoid getting savaged, the baboons with the lowest status would have to compulsively show that they knew they were defeated. They would do this by making what are called subordinance gestures. They lowered their head, crawled on their bellies. It was how they signaled, "Stop attacking me. I'm beaten. I'm no threat to you. I give up." And here's the striking thing. When a baboon is behaving this way, when nobody around him shows him any respect and he's been pushed to the bottom of the pile, he looks an awful lot like a depressed human being. He keeps his head down and his body low. He doesn't want to move. He loses his appetite. He loses all his energy. And when somebody comes near him, he backs away. One day, after Solomon had been at the top of the hierarchy for a year, a younger baboon, Uriah, did something shocking. When Solomon was lying on a rock with one of the hottest babes of the troop, Uriah walked up in between them and started trying to have sex with her right in front of the boss man. Incensed, Solomon attacked him and ripped Uriah's upper lip. Uriah ran away. But the next day, Uriah came back. And the next. And the next. He kept getting beaten up, but every time, Solomon got a little more exhausted and more wary. And then one day, when Uriah struck, Solomon backed off a little. Only for a moment. Within a year, Uriah was king, and Solomon had sunk to number 9 in the hierarchy, and everyone he had smited or spited was seeking revenge. The whole troop began to torment him, and his stress levels went through the roof. One day, Solomon was so despairing, he simply walked out into the savannah and never came back. Robert had discovered that our closest cousins are most stressed in two situations. When their status is threatened, like Solomon when Uriah struck, and when their status is low, like poor Job all the time. When he first published his research, it began to stir further scientific probing into these questions, and he rose to become a leading professor of biology and neurology at Stanford. A few years after Robert's initial breakthrough, it was discovered that depressed humans are flooded with the very same stress hormone that you find in low-ranking male baboons. As Robert investigated these questions further, he discovered even more. You get, he says, the same constellation of changes in the brain and pituitary and adrenal glands as in depressed humans too. So some other scientists began to suspect that depression might be, in part, something deep in our animal nature. The psychologist Paul Gilbert started to make the case that depression is for humans in part a submission response, the evolutionary equivalent of Job, the baboon at the bottom of the hierarchy, saying, "No more, please leave me alone. You don't have to fight me. I'm no threat to you." After I learned about this, I began to wonder, especially as I interviewed many depressed people, if depression is in part a response to the sense of humiliation the modern world inflicts on many of us. Watch TV, and you'll be told the only people who count in the world are celebrities and the rich, and you already know your chances of joining either group are vanishingly small. Flick through an Instagram feed or a glossy magazine, and your normal shaped body will feel disgusting to you. Go to work and you'll have to obey the whims of a distant boss earning hundreds of times more than you. Even when we are not being actively humiliated, even more of us feel like our status could be taken away at any moment. Even the middle class, even the rich, are made to feel pervasively insecure. Robert had discovered that having an insecure status was the one thing even more distressing than having a low status. So it seemed like there might be something in the theory that depression and anxiety are a response to the constant status anxiety many of us live with today. But how could this theory be tested? I went to see a married couple who taught me about this science and found an intriguing way of investigating it. Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson's research into these questions, distilled in their book The Spirit Level, has made them two of the most influential social scientists in the world. When they looked at Robert's work, they saw that with baboons, the hierarchies are fairly fixed. They are always going to live that way with only minor variations. But Kate and Richard knew that for humans, it doesn't quite work like that. As a species, we found lots of different ways to live together. Some human cultures, like the United States, have very large gaps between the people at the top and the people at the bottom. In those places, there's a small number of Solomons at the top, and most people are left like Job at the bottom. But other human cultures, like Norway, are quite different, with highly equal ways of living, where the top and bottom are close together. In those cultures, there are hardly any Solomons and hardly any Jobs. Most people live in a middle zone, like numbers 10 to 13 in the baboon hierarchy. If Robert's insights apply to humans, then Richard and Kate knew that in highly unequal societies like the United States, they would find higher levels of mental distress, and in highly equal societies like Norway, they'd find less. So they embarked on a massive research program to find out, sifting enormous amounts of data. When they were finally able to plot the data on a graph, they were startled by how close the relationship was. The more unequal your society, the more prevalent all forms of mental illness are. Other social scientists then broke this down to look at depression specifically, and they found the higher the inequality, the higher the depression. This is true if you compare different countries and if you compare different states within the United States. It strongly suggested that something about inequality seemed to be driving up depression and anxiety. When you have a society with huge gaps in income and status, Richard told me, it creates the sense that some people seem supremely important and others seem of no importance at all. This doesn't only affect people at the bottom. In a highly unequal society, everyone has to think about their status a lot. Am I maintaining my position? Who's threatening me? How far can I fall? Just asking these questions, as you have to when inequality grows, loads more and more stress onto our lives. This means that more people will unconsciously respond to this stress by offering a response from deep in our evolutionary history. We put our head down. We feel defeated. We're extraordinarily sensitive to these things, Richard said. When the status gap is too big, it creates a sense of defeat that you can't escape from. Today, we are living with status gaps that are bigger than any in human history. If you work for a company, in living memory, it used to be that your boss would earn 20 times more than the average employee. It's now 300 times more. The six heirs to the Walmart fortune own more than the bottom 100 million Americans. Eight billionaires own more wealth than the bottom half of the human race. Once you understand all this, Richard explained to me, you can see why the distress so many of us feel isn't due to some spontaneous misfiring of your brain chemistry. No, it is something, he told me, that you share with so many other people. This is a common human response to the circumstances in which we all live. This is not something that separates you from the world. It is actually something you share with countless others. We need to see this is not just my personal problem, he said, but a shared problem and attributable to the kind of society we live in. After he had returned from living with his troop of wild baboons on the savannas of Kenya, Robert Sapolsky had a recurring dream. He was on the New York subway, and a menacing gang approached him, determined to beat him up. Robert looked at the gang, terrified. There's a hierarchy here in this dream, and he's at the bottom of it. He's going to become prey, like Job, the weak baboon, covered in bite marks, because anybody could take a swing at him. But in the dream, Robert does something unexpected. He talks to the violent gang. He explains to the people who are poised to attack him that this is a crazy situation and it doesn't have to be this way. On some nights, he speaks to the thugs about the source of their pain, why they want to beat someone up, and he empathizes with them and their distress and offers a little impromptu therapy. Other times, he makes jokes and they laugh with him. Every time, they decide not to hurt him. I think this is a dream about how we can be. Baboons are locked in their hierarchy. They need someone at the bottom to beat up and humiliate. Job couldn't persuade Solomon to treat him well by offering jokes and therapy, and he couldn't persuade the other baboons to choose to live in a more egalitarian way. But humans do have a choice. We can, as I learned later, find practical ways to dismantle hierarchies and create a more equal place where everyone feels they have a measure of respect and status. Or we can build up hierarchies and ramp up the humiliation as we're doing today. When we do that, many of us will feel we're being pushed down, almost physically, and many of us will show signs of submission. We'll lower our heads in our bodies and silently say, "Leave me alone. You beat me. I can't take this anymore." Chapter 11. Course 6, Disconnection from the Natural World. Isabel Benke stood in the shadow of a mountain and looked at me. "I will only explain to you how being cut off from the natural world can cause depression," she said, "if you agree to climb it with me now." She waved her arms upward at Tunnel Mountain, which towers over the Canadian town of Banff. I followed her wave warily with my eyes. I couldn't see its peak anywhere, but I knew from the postcards it was somewhere above me, covered in snow, with lakes behind it in the distance. I coughed and explained to Isabel as politely as possible that I don't do nature. I like nice concrete walls covered with bookshelves. I like skyscrapers. I like subway stations opening out onto taco trucks. I regard Central Park as excessively rural and walk up 10th Avenue to avoid it. I go out into the natural world only when I'm forced to because I'm chasing a story. So Isabel explained, no mountain trek, no interview. "Come on," she said, "let's see where we can avoid dying and take a danger selfie." And so, reluctantly, for journalistic reasons only, I began to trudge. As we started to walk, it occurred to me that of all the people I know, Isabel is the one most likely to survive an apocalypse. She grew up on a farm in rural Chile, so I was always surprisingly comfortable with the wild, she told me as we walked. I was riding horses when I was 10 on my own and falling. My dad had eagles. We had 3 eagles living free inside the house. "Eagles in the house?" I asked. "Didn't they attack you?" "I come from a very unusual background," she replied, and we walked some more. Her family had been like a band of nomads roaming through nature. They would go sailing for days out into the ocean, and at the age of 8, Isabel would sketch the killer whales she had seen with her own eyes. Not long after, she started venturing into the rainforest for the first time. When she was in her early 20s, she started training to be an evolutionary biologist, which means, she says, that she studies the nature of human nature. Her job, operating out of Oxford University, is to figure out how we became the way we are, in part by studying our evolutionary ancestors and cousins. Her first major piece of research was at Twycross Zoo in southern England, where her project was to study the differences between chimpanzees and bonobos in captivity. Bonobos look like slimmer chimpanzees, and they have funny hair. It's parted in the middle and flips up, resembling an airplane that's about to take off. They grow to be large. An adult is about the size of a 12-year-old human child. As Isabel watched them, she quickly observed the most famous thing about bonobos. They bond by having very frequent group sex, most of which is lesbian. Isabel loved to watch as the British mothers unwittingly brought their young children to witness this orgy. "Mummy, mummy, what are they doing?" they would ask. The mothers would quickly shepherd their kids away to the Galapagos tortoises in a pen opposite. But then breeding season came for the tortoises, and you have no idea how pornographic tortoises can be, Isabel says, because the male mounts the female and the male makes that sound. From her observation spot in the zoo, Isabel would cackle as pale English mothers staggered from the bonobo orgies to the orgasming tortoises, muttering, "Oh my God, oh my God." There, she fell in love with the bonobos and with their whole way of looking at the world. She was especially impressed when she saw one of the female bonobos make a dildo. She was given food one day in a bucket that was kind of cut in half, a blue bucket, Isabel says, and she rolled it up and she took it wherever she went and she would just use it to masturbate. Amazing. "And then I understood it," Isabel says, "because of course plastic is smooth. Are you going to use branches? It's not so smooth." It was like a kind of genius solution. There was something wrong with these bonobos, something Isabel wasn't going to understand until later. She realized that if she really wanted to understand this species, she had to follow them out into their natural habitat in the center of Africa. But nobody had done that for years. A horrific war had been destroying the Democratic Republic of Congo, although it now seemed to be drawing to a close. When she told people what she wanted to do, they looked at her as if she was mad. But Isabel is not a woman many people can say no to. That's how she ended up, after a lot of lobbying, in the heart of the Congolese rainforest for 3 years, living in a house made of mud and stalking a troop of bonobos all day, every day. She walked on average 17 kilometers a day. She got charged by a wild boar. In this time, she learned to understand bonobos better than almost anyone else alive. And there, she realized something with implications for us. Out in the Congo, she noticed that many of the things she'd seen the bonobos do when they were taken out of their natural habitat and put in the zoo, things she took to be normal, were actually highly unusual. In the rainforest, the landscape they evolved to live in, bonobos will sometimes be bullied by their social group. And when this happens, they start behaving differently. They might scratch themselves a lot, compulsively. They'll sit at the edge of the group and stare out. They'll groom themselves a lot less, and they'll refuse to be groomed by other bonobos. When Isabel saw this behavior, she recognized it right away. It was, she believed, clearly the bonobo equivalent of depression, for the same reasons I described in the last chapter. They were being treated badly, and they were reacting with sadness and a loss of hope. But here's the strange thing. In the wild, for bonobos, there's a limit to how far this depression goes. It's there, especially for the low-status ones, but there's a floor below which the animals won't sink. Yet in zoos, it seemed the bonobos would slip further and further down, in a way they never would in the wild. They would start scratching until they bled. They would howl. They would develop tics or start rocking obsessively. In their natural habitat, she never saw the bonobos develop this full-blown chronic depression, she says, but in zoos it was quite common. This isn't limited to bonobos, it turns out. We now know from over a century of observing animals in captivity that when they are deprived of their natural habitat, they will often develop symptoms that look like extreme forms of despair. Parrots will rip their own feathers out. Horses will start unstoppably swaying. Elephants will begin to grind their tusks, their source of strength and pride in the wild, against the walls of their cells until they are gnarled stumps. Some elephants in captivity are so traumatized they sleep upright for years, moving their bodies neurotically the whole time. None of these species ever behave this way in the wild. Many animals in captivity lose their desire to have sex. That's why it's so hard to get animals to mate in zoos. So Isabel began to ask, why would animals become far more depressed outside their natural habitat? This became quite a personal question for her when she was writing up some of her research at Oxford College. Stuck inside all day, trying to work, she found herself depressed for the first time in her life. She couldn't sleep, couldn't bring her mind to focus on how to get out of her terrible sense of pain. She took antidepressants, but like most people who take them, she was still depressed. She started to ask herself, could her own depression be linked to the depression she'd seen in the caged bonobos? What if, she wondered, humans become more depressed when we're deprived of access to the kind of landscape we evolved in too? Was that why she felt so bad? It's been known for a long time that all sorts of mental health problems, including ones as severe as psychosis and schizophrenia, are considerably worse in cities than in the countryside, but the psychological effects of being cut off from the natural world have only begun to be studied properly in the last 15 years. A group of scientists at the University of Essex in Britain have conducted the most detailed research into this question so far. They tracked the mental health of more than 5,000 households over 3 years. They wanted to look at two types of households in particular. People who moved from a leafy green rural area to a city, and people who moved from a city to a leafy green rural area. They wanted to know, would there be any changes in how depressed they got? What they found was clear. The people who moved to green areas saw a big reduction in depression, and the people who moved away from green areas saw a big increase in depression. This was just one of many studies with similar findings, it turns out. Of course, the scientists looking at this knew there are all sorts of things that could be playing a role here. Maybe rural areas have stronger communities and less crime and less pollution, and maybe that, rather than the green space, is why people feel better. So another British study decided to screen out that effect. They compared deprived inner city areas that had some green space to very similar deprived inner city areas without green space. Everything else, like levels of social connections, was the same. But it turned out there was less stress and despair in the greener neighbourhood. As I read through all this evidence, one of the studies that was most striking to me was perhaps the most simple. They got people who lived in cities to take a walk in nature and then tested their mood and concentration. Everyone predictably felt better and was able to concentrate more. But the effect was dramatically bigger for people who had been depressed. Their improvement was 5 times greater than the improvement for other people. Why would this be? What was going on? We were halfway up the mountain, and Isabel was staring off towards the lakes in the distance, when I confessed something to her. I could see this scene was beautiful in some abstract way, but I'm so cut off from enjoying this sort of thing that, to me, what it looked like, if I'm honest, was a screensaver, a lovely screensaver. I felt an unconscious itch when I looked at it. I felt as if I'd waited too long before pushing a key on my laptop. Isabel laughed, but it was a sad laugh. Now I feel personally responsible if you feel this is a screensaver. I feel it's my mission. I cannot feel there's any integrity in talking about this and then saying, let's go back to sit in front of a screen. She made me promise we'd make it to the top of the mountain. So we started to trudge upward again, and as we talked more, I learned that Isabel had essentially distilled her thoughts on this subject, which draw on a broad range of science, down to 3 theories. She says candidly that we need a lot more research into all of them, and they overlap to some degree. To understand why we feel better in landscapes like this, she said, you have to start with something really basic. The thing is that we are animals. We keep forgetting that, she said. And as animals, she indicated towards her body, this thing is made to move. When we look for solutions to our bad feelings, she says, we try to find it in language and in the symbols we've created as a species. But these symbols are, in the long sweep of things, very recent. She said, we have been invertebrate for nearly 500 million years now. We have been mammals for 250, 300 million years. We've been primates for 65 million years. All those years she spent in the Congolese rainforest, living and sleeping and eating with the bonobos, she explained, she was being educated in how close we are to them. We have been animals that move for a lot longer than we've been animals that talk and convey concepts, she said to me. But we still think that depression can be cured by this conceptual layer. I think the first answer is more simple. Let's fix the physiology first. Get out. Move. It's hard for a hungry animal moving through its natural habitat and with a decent sense of status in its group to be depressed, she says. There are almost no records of such a thing. The scientific evidence is clear that exercise significantly reduces depression and anxiety. She thinks this is because it returns us to our more natural state. When we are embodied, we are animal, we are moving, our endorphins are rushing. I do not think that kids or adults who are not moving and are not in nature for a certain amount of time can be considered fully healthy animals, she says. But there must be, she says, something deeper going on than that. When scientists have compared people who run on treadmills in the gym with people who run in nature, they found that both see a reduction in depression, but it's higher for the people who run in nature. So what are the other factors? As we reached this part of our conversation, I realized we were standing at the top of the mountain. On either side, I could see sweeping vistas. Now, Isabel said, you have screensavers on both sides. We're surrounded. A chipmunk was tentatively approaching us, and it walked up to a point just a few inches from my feet. On the ground, I laid down a piece of jerky I'd bought in town earlier that day. There's another theory put forward by scientists about why being in the natural world seems to lift depression for many people, Isabel said to me. The biologist E.O. Wilson, one of the most important people in this field in the 20th century, argued that all humans have a natural sense of something called biophilia. It's an innate love for the landscapes in which human beings have lived for most of our existence, and for the natural web of life that surrounds us and makes our existence possible. Almost all animals get distressed if they're deprived of the kinds of landscape that they evolved to live in. a frog can live on land, it'll just be miserable as hell and give up. Why, Isabel wonders, would humans be the one exception to this rule? Looking around us, Isabel says, fucking hell, it's our habitat. This is a hard concept to test scientifically, but there's been one attempt to do it. The social scientists Gordon Oriens and Judith Heerwagen worked with teams all over the world in radically different cultures and showed them a range of pictures of very different landscapes, from the desert to the city to the savannah. What they found is that everywhere, no matter how different their culture, people had a preference for landscapes that look like the savannas of Africa. There's something about it, they conclude, that seems to be innate. This leads to another reason. Isabel thinks depressed or anxious people feel better when they get out into natural landscapes. When you are depressed, as Isabel knows from her own experience, you feel that now everything is about you. You become trapped in your own story and your own thoughts, and they rattle around in your head with a dull, bitter insistence. Becoming depressed or anxious is a process of becoming a prisoner of your own ego, where no air from the outside can get in. But a range of scientists have shown that a common reaction to being out in the natural world is the precise opposite of this sensation, a feeling of awe. Faced with a natural landscape, you have a sense that you and your concerns are very small and the world is very big, and that sensation can shrink your ego down to a manageable size. It's something larger than yourself, Isabel said, looking around her. There's something very deeply, animally healthy in that sensation. People love it when it occurs. It's brief, fleeting moments. And this helps you see the deeper and wider ways in which you're connected to everything around you. It's almost like a metaphor for belonging in a grander system, she says. You're always embedded in a network, even when you don't realize it. You're just one more node in this enormous tapestry. In Oxford, she found it easy to become depressed when she was sealed away from all this. In Congo, living with the bonobos, she found she couldn't get depressed. She would sometimes have a bleak thought, and as she put it, nature goes, I don't think so. You're camping in the savannah and you hear lions roar and you think, oh fuck, I'm protein. That release from self-enclosure in her own ego, she says, released her from despair. The chipmunk sniffed the jerky I'd laid down on the ground, looked disgusted and scampered away. It's only when I looked at the package that I realized what I'd offered him was something called salmon jerky, which apparently Canadians voluntarily choose to eat. The chipmunk has excellent taste, Isabel said, looking at the packaging in horror, and started to lead me back down the mountain. In the state prison of southern Michigan in the 1970s, there was, quite by accident, an experiment exploring some of these ideas. Because of the way the prison was built, half the prisoners' cells looked out over rolling farmland and trees, and half looked out onto bare brick walls. An architect called Ernest Moore studied the medical records for these different groups of prisoners, who didn't differ in any other way. And he found that if you were in the group who could see the natural world, you were 24% less likely to get physically or mentally sick. I have to say, Professor Howard Frumkin, one of the leading experts on this subject in the world, told me later, that if we had a medication for which preliminary results showed such efficacy, we would be all over researching that medication. Here is a treatment that has very few side effects, is not expensive, doesn't require a trained or licensed professional to prescribe it, and has pretty good evidence of efficacy so far. But the research is very hard to find funding for, he said, because a lot of the shape of the modern biomedical research has been defined by the pharmaceutical industry. And they're not interested because, as he put it, it's very hard to commercialize nature contact. You can't sell it, so they don't want to know. But I kept wondering, as I absorbed all this, so why have I been so resistant to the natural world all my life? It was only when I thought about this for months and listened again and again to the audio of my mountain trek with Isabel that I realized something. In nature, I do feel my ego shrinking, and I do feel a sensation that I'm very small and the world is very big, just as she predicted. Yet for most of my life, that has caused me a sensation not of relief, but of anxiety. I want my ego. I want to cling to it. It was only later in this journey that I understood this properly. As you'll see. Isabel had seen captivity reduce bonobos to depression-like symptoms they could not have experienced in the wild. As humans, she told me, I think we have many modern forms of captivity. The lesson the depressed bonobos have taught her, she said, is don't be in captivity. Fuck captivity. Right at the top of that mountain in Banff, there is a ledge where if you walk along it, you have a view in every direction over the Canadian landscape, stretching out before it. I looked on it with terror. Isabel insisted on taking my hand and leading me out there. The cruelest thing about depression, she said, is that it drains you of the desire to be as fully alive as this, to swallow experience whole. We want to feel alive, she said. We want it and need it so badly. Later, she said, obviously, we were facing death, but you felt alive, right? You might have been horrified, but you were not depressed. No, I was not depressed. Chapter 12. Cause 7. Disconnection from a hopeful or secure future. I had noticed something else about my depression and anxiety over the years. It often made me feel, in some peculiar way, radically short-sighted. When it came, I would only be able to think about the next few hours, how long they would seem and how painful they would be. It was as if the future vanished. As I talked with many depressed or severely anxious people, I noticed that they often described a similar sensation. One friend told me that she always knew her depression was lifting when she felt her sense of time expanding again. She would find herself able to think about where she would be a month from then or a year from then. I wanted to understand this apparent quirk, and once I began to dig into it, it led me to some remarkable scientific research. Of all the causes of depression and anxiety I learned about, this was the one it took me longest to absorb. But once I did, it helped me to clear up several mysteries. Not long before he died, a Native American called Chief Plenty Coo sat in his home on the flatlands of Montana and looked out across a landscape where once his people had roamed alongside the buffalo, and now there was nothing. He had been born in the last days when his people, the Crow, had lived as a nomadic hunting tribe. One day, a white cowboy appeared and said he wanted to tell the chief's story, to faithfully record it in the chief's own words, for the ages. Many white men had stolen Native American stories and warped them, so it took a long time to build trust between these two men. But once it was there, Chief Plenty Coo began to tell this man a story. It was about the end of the world. When he was young, he explained, his people had ranged across the Great Plains on horseback, and their lives had always been organized around two crucial activities. They hunted, and they prepared for the wars they fought against rival Native American tribal groups in their area. Everything they did was designed to prepare them for one of these two organizing poles of life. If you cooked a meal, it was in preparation for the hunt or for the fight. If you conducted the ceremonial sundance, it was to ask for strength in the hunt or in the fight. Even your name and the name of everyone you knew was based on your role in the hunt or in the fight. This was the world. He described its many rules. For example, at the heart of the Crow worldview was the idea of planting something called a coup stick, a carved wooden spike. As you traveled across the plains, you would mark out your own tribe's territory by planting a coup stick in the ground. This stick meant anyone who passes beyond this point is an enemy and will be attacked. The most admirable thing you could do in the Crow culture was to plant and defend the coup sticks. They were at the core of their moral vision. Chief Plenty Coo continued to describe the rules of his lost world in great detail. He conjured his life, the spiritual values of his people, their relationship with the buffalo and with their rival tribes. It was a world as complex as the civilizations of Europe or China or India, and a structure with rules and meaning and metaphor. But the cowboy noticed there was something strange about this story. The chief was just a teenager when the white Europeans came, and the wild buffalo were all killed, and the Crow were killed, and the survivors were penned into reservations. But the chief's story always ended there. As for the rest of his life, the majority of it, he had no stories. He had nothing to say. He would get to the point where the Crow were shut into reservations and say, after this, nothing happened. Of course, the cowboy knew, everyone knew, that the chief had done many more things in his life. A lot had happened. but in a very real sense, the world had ended for him and for his people. Sure, on the reservation they could still plant acoustics in the ground, but it made no sense. Who was going to cross them? How would they be defended? Sure, they could talk about courage, the value they most cherished, but how could they show courage in any way that made sense to them when there was no more hunting, no more fighting? Sure, they could still perform the sun dance, but why bother when there were no hunts and no battles to ask for success in? How could you show ambition or spirit or bravery? Even everyday activities seemed pointless. Before, meals had been preparation for the hunt or the fight. Obviously, the crows continued to cook meals, the philosopher Jonathan Lear explained when he wrote about this. And if asked, they could say what they were doing. And if asked further about it, they could say they were trying to survive, trying to hold the family together from one day to the next. But there was no larger framework of significance into which it could fit. A century later, a psychology professor named Michael Chandler made a discovery. He had been watching on the news, like so many of his fellow Canadians, as a horrifying story was reported year after year. Scattered across this country, there were 196 First Nations groups, the Canadian term for the Native American groups, who were able to survive the European invasion, albeit on reservations, disorientated like Chief Plenty Coup and his Crow people. Like in the United States, successive Canadian governments had for many years resolved to destroy their culture by taking their children away from them and raising them in orphanages, banning them from speaking their own languages, and preventing them from having any say over how they lived. This continued until a few decades ago. The result was that the people who had gone through all this and their children had the highest levels of suicide in the country. By 2016, this became a front page issue in Canada when in a single reservation on a single night, 11 First Nations people killed themselves. Michael had wanted to understand why. So in the 1990s, he started to look at the statistics about suicides among First Nations people to see where they were happening. He noticed something intriguing. Some Indigenous nations, or tribes as they would be called in the United States, had no suicides at all, while others had extraordinarily high rates. Why would this be? What could explain the difference? What was happening in the no-suicide Indigenous nations that wasn't happening in the high-suicide Indigenous nations? He had a hunch. Governments historically have treated Indigenous people as children and assumed some kind of loco parentis, acting as parents, control over their lives, Michael explained to me. But in the last decades, Indigenous groups have fought against this kind of approach and tried to reassemble control of their own lives. Some have been able to reclaim control of their traditional lands, revive their own languages and get control of their own schools, health services and police, so they can elect them and run them by themselves. In some places, the authorities have given in to organising by First Nations people and conceded some freedoms, and in others they haven't. This means there's a big gap between those First Nations groups that are still totally controlled and at the mercy of whatever decisions are made by the Canadian government about them, and other Indigenous nations who've been able to achieve some freedom to rebuild a culture that makes sense to them, to try to build a world where, in their terms, something happens. So Michael and his colleagues spent years carefully gathering and studying the statistics. They developed 9 ways to measure the control a tribal group had, and slowly, over time, they plotted this against the suicide statistics. What they wanted to know was, is there a relationship? Then they compiled the results. It turned out the communities with the highest control had the lowest suicide, and the communities with the lowest control had the highest suicide. If you plotted these two factors on a graph across these 196 tribal groups, it was a remarkably straight line. You could very often predict the rate of suicide just by looking at the rate of community control. This is certainly not the only factor causing agony to First Nations people. To name just one of many, the fact that their families were deliberately destroyed and broken up by the Canadian state, and that they were sent to horribly abusive boarding schools, has created a cascade of trauma down the generations. But Michael had proven that a lack of community control was a massive and major factor. This discovery was explosive in itself, but it then led Michael to think more deeply still. As he looked at the results from the First Nations study, Michael found himself thinking back to a study he'd carried out several years before. It's a little more complex than the studies I've discussed up to now, but stick with me. Ever since he graduated from the University of California in Berkeley as a young psychologist in 1966, Michael had been curious about one of the oldest and most fundamental questions humans have. How do you develop your sense of identity? How do you know who you are? It seems like an impossibly big question, but ask yourself this. What is the connecting thread that runs from your baby self, vomiting out teething biscuits, to the person who's listening to this audiobook now? Will you be the same person 20 years from now? If you met her, would you recognize her? What is the relationship between you in the past and you in the future? Are you the same person all along? Almost everyone finds these questions hard to answer. We instinctively feel that we're the same person all through our lives, but we find it hard to explain why. There is one group of people, however, who seem to find it impossible. Michael went into a psychiatric unit in Vancouver for teenagers, and he spent months interviewing the kids there. They were living in bunk beds, receiving treatment, and often covering up the scars on their arms in shame. He asked them many kinds of questions about their lives. Some of his questions went to the heart of this debate. How do you form your identity? He raised this topic with them in different ways, and one was quite simple. In Canada, they have a series of books that turns classic novels into comic books. One of them is an adaptation of the Charles Dickens story, A Christmas Carol. You probably know the plot. It's the story of an old miser named Scrooge, who's visited by three ghosts and is transformed by the experience and becomes super generous. Another comic book is an adaptation of the Victor Hugo classic Les Misérables. You probably know this one too. A poor man named Jean Valjean commits a crime and runs away. He changes his name and identity and rises to become the mayor of his town until Inspector Javert comes to hunt him down and sings some terrible musical numbers. Michael got two different groups of institutionalized teenagers to read these comic books. One group consisted of teenagers who had anorexia that was bad enough for them to be hospitalized. The other group consisted of teenagers who had been suicidally depressed. He asked both groups of kids to think about these characters. Will Scrooge be the same person in the future after he meets the ghosts and goes through a change of heart? If he is, why? Will Jean Valjean be the same man after he runs away and changes his name? Tell me how. Both groups of kids were equally sick, and their distress levels were similar. Yet the anorexic kids could answer these questions normally, while the depressed kids couldn't. Almost unique to the suicidal group was a kind of across-the-board failure to be able to understand how a person could go on being the same individual, Michael told me. The very depressed kids could answer all sorts of other questions normally, but when it came to these questions about what they or anyone else would be in the future, they would look puzzled. They would know they should be able to give an answer, but then they would say sadly, "I don't have the foggiest idea." And here's the interesting thing. Just as they couldn't see who Jean Valjean would be in the future, it turned out they couldn't see who they, as individuals, would be in the future either. For them, the future had disappeared. Asked to describe themselves 5 or 10 or 20 years from now, they were at a loss. It was like a muscle they couldn't work. At some profound level, Michael had discovered, extremely depressed people had become disconnected from a sense of the future in a way that other really distressed people have not. From this early research, though, it was hard to tell if these kids' symptoms were a cause or an effect. It could go either way. Maybe losing a sense of the future makes you suicidal, or maybe being extremely depressed makes it hard to think about the future. How, he wondered, could he figure this out? The research into First Nations Canadians, he came to believe, gives you an answer. If you live in a First Nations community with no control over its destiny, it's hard to construct a picture of a hopeful or stable future in your mind. You're at the mercy of alien forces that have destroyed your people many times before. But if you live in a First Nations community that does have control over its destiny, you can easily construct a vision of a hopeful future, because together you'll be deciding it. It was, he concluded, the loss of the future that was driving the suicide rates up. A sense of a positive future protects you. If life is bad today, you can think, this hurts, but it won't hurt forever. But when it's taken away, it can feel like your pain will never go away. After conducting this research, Michael told me he is now highly skeptical about the way we talk about depression and anxiety as if they were mainly caused by defects in our brain or genes. It's a kind of holdover from a highly westernized, medicalized vision of health and well-being, he told me, and it lacks any serious appreciation of the cultural context in which these things are happening. If you act this way, he said, you ignore the legitimacy of being depressed for many people who've been stripped of hope. instead of thinking about these causes of depression, though, we've been simply putting people on drugs. And he said, that's become an industry. When I was back in London for a while, I arranged to meet up with an old friend I'd known at university 12 years before, but had somehow lost touch with over the years. I'll call her Angela. When we studied together, she was one of those people who seemed to be doing everything all at once, starring in a play, reading Tolstoy, being everyone's best friend, going out with the hottest boys. She was like a firework of adrenaline, cocktails and old books. But I'd heard from some of our mutual friends that in the years since, she'd developed a serious problem with anxiety and depression, and this seemed so incongruous that I wanted to talk with her. I took her for a long lunch, and she started to tell me the story of her life since we last met, in a hurried gabble, punctuated by her apologising a lot, although it was never quite clear what for. After we graduated, Angela explained, she earned a master's degree, and when she started to apply for jobs, she kept getting a consistent piece of feedback. They said she was overqualified, and that if they offered her a place, she would only leave. This dragged on for months, and then a year had passed, and she was still hearing the same thing. Angela was a hard worker, and being out of work was weird for her. In the end, she couldn't pay the bills, so she applied for a shift at a call centre at about £8, which is around $10 US, an hour, a little above Britain's minimum wage at the time. On her first day, she arrived at an old paint mixing factory in East London. There was a row of plastic top desks with skinny legs, the kind you find in British elementary schools, with computers on them. And in the centre, at a bigger desk, sat a supervisor. He could be listening in on your calls at any time, she was told, and he will give you feedback. The centre made calls on behalf of three of Britain's leading charities, and Angela's job was to cold call people and get through what they called three asks. First, you ask for a big sum. Could you afford £50 a month? If they say no, you ask for a smaller sum. How about £20? If they say no, they ask, how about £2 a month? Your call only counts as a success if you can manage to get in all three asks. At this centre, there were no jobs, in the old sense that Angela's grandparents, who had been a servant girl and a factory worker, would have known. If we keep you on, the supervisor explained, you'll get an email once a week listing your shifts for the following week. You might get four, you might get none. It's up to me and how well you perform day by day. At the end of the first day, the supervisor told her she was doing the calls all wrong, and if she didn't improve, she wouldn't get another shift. She had to be more assertive. You had to maintain a high rate of people letting you hit them with your three asks, and then you needed a high rate of people saying yes. She learned over the next few weeks that if your rate dropped even 2% from your previous shift, the supervisor would scream at you and it might well be your last shift. Sometimes Angela would cold call people and they would tell her crying they could no longer afford to donate. I know the blind children need me, one old woman sobbed. Maybe I can buy a different brand of dog food, she said, so she could give the penny she saved to the blind. Angela was instructed to go in for the kill. For the first month, Angela thought she would get better at it, and the work would become tolerable until finally she got a proper job. I'd be like, I don't really like it, but it'll be okay. It'll be okay, she told me. In the weeks when she got four shifts, she was finally able to take the bus to work and to buy a whole chicken that she would strip to make several meals throughout the week. In the weeks when she got two shifts or fewer, she ate beans and walked to work. Her boyfriend was forced into doing similarly chronically insecure work, and one day he got sick. She found herself feeling furious at him for not forcing herself to go in. Don't you know we need that £60? It was at the start of the second month that Angela realised she was shaking on the bus every day on the way to work. She couldn't tell why. After work, she would sometimes let herself buy a half pint of Guinness in the pub across the street, and for the first time in her life, she found herself crying in public. Around the same time, she also found herself becoming angry in a way she had never been before. Sometimes there would be a batch of new applicants for shifts, and so her own shifts would be cut back. You start to really hate the new people, she said. She and her boyfriend were starting to scream at each other over little things. When I asked her to describe how she felt doing this work, she paused. It's like being squeezed, like trying to fit down a very tight tube all the time. You know, like trying to go down a slide and just realizing everything about you is not right, and not being able to breathe, and feeling quite sick and like you'll never get out, and feeling stupid, incompetent, like a child who can't manage their own life. So you've been relegated to the shitty world where people can tell you you're not good enough and fire you like that. And she snapped her fingers. Angela's grandmother had a job as a maid, and she'd get her contract renewed once a year on Ladies' Day. Angela's mother had a middle-class job with a permanent contract. Angela felt she'd regressed back beyond even what her grandmother had in the 1930s. She was auditioning for her job every hour, every call, she said. It made her feel frightened of going into work because of how horrible the day would be and the fear this would be the day, she said, I really fucked up and got fired and then we would be in trouble. She realized one day that she could never shake off what she called that sense of having no future. She couldn't even plan a few days ahead. When she heard friends talking about mortgages and pensions, it sounded to her almost utopian, dispatches from a country she could only visit. It completely takes away any sense of identity you might have and replaces it with shame and worry and fear, she said. What are you? I'm nothing. What are you? She couldn't conjure any sense of herself in the future that looked any different from the way it did today. I'm terrified of being as poor when we're in our 60s and 70s as we were in our 20s, she said. It felt like an eternal traffic jam where she would never move an inch. She started drinking cheap alcohol at night because she was too anxious to close her eyes. For the past 30 years, across almost all of the Western world, this kind of insecurity has been characterizing work for more and more people. Around 20% of people in the United States and Germany have no job contract, but instead have to work from shift to shift. The Italian philosopher Paolo Virno has said that we've moved from having a proletariat, a solid block of manual workers with jobs, to a precariat, a shifting mass of chronically insecure people who don't know whether they'll have any work next week and may never have a stable job. When Angela had a sense of a positive future, back when we were students, she'd been a whirl of positivity. Now, sitting opposite me, talking about being choked off from a sense of a hopeful future, she was drained. Almost affectless. There was a window when people on middle class and working class incomes had some sense of security and could plan for the future. That window has been closing as a direct result of political decisions to free businesses from regulation and to make it very hard for workers to organize to protect their rights. And what we are losing as a result is a predictable sense of the future. Angela didn't know what was waiting for her. Working this way meant she couldn't create a picture of herself in a few months, never mind in a few years or a few decades. First, this sense of precariousness started with people in the lowest paying jobs, but ever since it's been rising further and further up the chain. By now, many middle class people are working from task to task without any contractual security. We give it a fancy name. We call it being self-employed or the gig economy, as if we're all Kanye playing Madison Square Garden. For most of us, a stable sense of the future is dissolving, and we're told to see it as a form of liberation. It would be grotesque to compare what's happened to workers in the West to what's happened to the native peoples of the Americas, who survived a genocide and more than a century of persecution. But while I researched this book, I spent some time in the Rust Belt. A few weeks before the US presidential election in 2016, I went to Cleveland to try to get the vote out to stop Donald Trump from being elected. One afternoon, I walked down a street in the southwest of the city where a third of the houses had been demolished by the authorities, a third were abandoned, and a third still had people living in them, cowering with steel guards on their windows. I knocked on a door, and a woman answered who, from looking at her, I would have guessed was 55. She began to rage, how terrified she was of her neighbours, how the kids in the area have got to go, how she was desperate for anyone who would make things better, how there wasn't even a grocery store anywhere nearby anymore, and she had to take three buses just to get food. She mentioned in passing that she was 37 years old, which took me aback. And then she said something that stayed with me long after the election. She described what the area was like when her grandparents lived there, and you could work in a factory and have a middle-class life. And she made a verbal slip. She meant to say, when I was young. What she actually said was, when I was alive. After she said that, I remembered what that Crow member told an anthropologist in the 1890s. I am trying to live a life I do not understand. Angela and my other friends who've been swallowed into the precariat can't make sense of their lives either. The future is constantly fragmenting. All the expectations they were raised with for what comes next seems to have vanished. When I told Angela about Michael Chandler's studies, she smiled sadly. It made intuitive sense to her, she said. When you have a stable picture of yourself in the future, she explained, what it gives you is perspective, doesn't it? You're able to say, okay, I'm having a shitty day, but I'm not having a shitty life. She never expected, she says, to be partying with Jay-Z or to own a yacht, but she did expect to be able to plan on an annual vacation. She did expect, by the time she got into her late 30s, to know who her employer would be next week and the week after that. But instead, she got trapped in the precariat. And after that, nothing happened. Chapter 13. Causes 8 and 9. The real role of genes and brain changes. The story we've been told about our brains, that we are depressed and anxious because they are simply and spontaneously low in serotonin, is not, I knew by now, true. Yet I saw that some people conclude from this that none of the biological stories on this subject we've been told are right, that they are entirely caused by social and psychological factors. But when I interviewed them, even the strongest advocates for the environmental and social causes of depression stressed to me that the biological causes do exist and are very real. So I wanted to investigate, what role do they play? How do they work? And how do they relate to everything else I had learned? Mark Lewis's friends thought he was dead. It was the summer of 1969, and this young student in California was desperate to block out his despair any way he could. He had swallowed, snorted, or injected any stimulant he could find for a week now. After he'd been awake for 36 hours straight, he got a friend to inject him with heroin so he could finally crash. When Mark regained consciousness, he realized his friends were trying to figure out where they could find a bag big enough to dump his body in. When Mark suddenly began to talk, they were freaked out. His heart, they explained to him, had stopped beating for several minutes. Finally, about 10 years after that night, Mark left drugs behind, and he started to study neuroscience. By the time I first met him, initially in Sydney, Australia, he was a leading figure in the field and a professor in the Netherlands. He wanted to know, how does your brain change when you are deeply distressed? Do those changes make it harder to recover? If you look at the brain scan of a depressed or highly anxious person, Mark explained to me, it will look different from the brain scan of somebody without these problems. The areas that relate to feeling unhappy or to being aware of risk will be lit up like Christmas tree lights. They'll be bigger and more active. He showed me diagrams and traced these parts of the brain for me. This fits, I told him, with what my doctor told me back in my teens, that I was depressed because my brain was physically broken and it would have to be fixed with drugs. So was that story right all along? When I said that, he looked sad and said, no, it doesn't mean that at all. To understand why, he said, you have to grasp a crucial concept called neuroplasticity. 15 years ago, if you had shown me a diagram of my brain and described what it was like, I and most people would have thought, that's me then. If the parts of the brain that relate to being unhappy or being frightened are more active, that I'm fixed as a person who's always going to be more unhappy or more frightened. You might have short legs or long arms. I have a brain with more active parts related to fear and anxiety. That's how it is. But now we know that this is not the case. Think of it, he explained, in a different way. If I showed you an x-ray of a man's arms, they might look spindly and weak. Now imagine he did a weight training course for 6 months and then came back for another x-ray. His arms would look different. They aren't fixed. They would change according to how he used them. Your brain, he said, is just like that. It changes according to how you use it. Neuroplasticity is the tendency for the brain to continue to restructure itself based on experience, he said. So, for example, to get their license, London taxi drivers have to memorize the entire map of London for a fiercely difficult test called the knowledge. If you do a brain scan of a London taxi driver, the part of the brain related to spatial awareness is much bigger in him than it would be in me or you. It doesn't mean he was born different. It means he uses his brain differently in his life. Your brain is constantly changing to meet your needs. It does this mainly in two ways, by pruning the synapses you don't use and by growing the synapses you do use. So, for example, if you raise a baby in total darkness, the baby will shed the synapses that relate to eyesight. the brain has figured out he won't need them, and that it's better to deploy that brain power somewhere else. For as long as you live,